Doubly. Hi, my name is Mike Bach. I'm an alcoholic. And, I was thinking about doing this and thinking that, you're supposed to get comfortable with something after you've done it a few times. And the fact of the matter is I don't. And I think there's something to that. I was with Mark when he asked Gene to give the 15-minute talk. And he's like, Gene, you want to do 15 minutes? He's like, no. And to me, it's one of these things where we rely on something outside of ourselves, the fellowship in God, to get us through these things that we have to do, that we're asked to do for AA, that keep us sober. And it's amazing how you can just really not want to do something, but when your mind and heart are in the right place, a wonderful story comes out. And I really enjoyed hearing what Gene had to say, and I don't know if I'm going to measure up to it. I got to say that when I was a kid, starting around 12 years old, I went up to Canada a lot because I was really into hockey. And there's something comforting about that French-Canadian accent to me when I hear it, because that's how everybody talked when I go and play hockey every summer. And my hockey career didn't pan out as I would have hoped, because when I was 12, I was eye level with everybody. But when I was 14, I was looking up. And I was 16, I was looking way up, because I didn't grow until I was late. That was one of many things that started making me feel different, that I didn't measure up, was that I couldn't compete athletically because I didn't have the size. And, that was just one of many things that I began to believe about myself, that, I didn't measure up. And I related to what Gene said a lot about I just needed a break. That's the best way I can describe it. I loved the break that alcohol afforded me so much that I wanted to be on break all the time. Just kind of like at work, I mean, who wants to work at work? I want to be on break, So, anyway, I got sober on June 3rd of 2003. So what that means to me is from that day to this one, I haven't had anything to drink, any drugs, anything really else to tune my head. And it's strictly through AA that I have that time and I have the life I have today. I endeavor to achieve some level of sobriety or happiness doing thousands, well, not thousands, but lots of other things, as most of us have in the stories that I hear, to get sober, to not live this way before coming to AA. There was something about AA that I dreaded, even though I really knew nothing about it. I just knew that you didn't want to end up here, And so I didn't. And, so there was counseling and there was head shrinks and there was all that kind of stuff. And I honestly don't know. I know for sure that I didn't try any of them in earnest. I don't know if they would have worked out if I did. But I'm also very happy that I didn't try those things and that I did try AA and that I did do AA and that I did stay in AA, because it afforded me a life, again, that I couldn't have dreamed or imagined for myself. And who would have thunk that you can be pretty much a useless gutter drunk and turn your life around in such a way where people want you back in their lives again, and where you get up every morning and you're not cursing, which I did a lot before I got here. It's a tremendous gift that I think anyone can appreciate, but I know AA's appreciate it. Just that idea of waking up in the morning and not saying crap, So anyway, I have a home group, and I'm sponsored, and I have the privilege of sponsoring others. And I guess I'll start. When I was a kid, I came up in a home that I don't know how to compare to other people's upbringings. I know I wasn't beaten and I wasn't smacked around, or anything like that. I didn't. There was nothing tragic, nothing that would make the news, much less the local community paper or a police blotter that happened in my home. My parents taught me good values. They expected a lot. I mean, sure they were controlling, but I think in my experience, anybody's controlling by an alcoholic's measurement, And so, but at the same time, I was a very compliant kid. I was scared of breaking the rules. My dad, like I said, didn't smack me around or anything, but he had a very big presence. And the way I was brought up, and it's not just that I was brought up, but it's probably just what I heard, is that if I disobeyed, that there was going to be trouble, not just now, but in the hereafter as well. So I better not do that. So I didn't really do anything rebellious. I had some issues that they would send me to the shrinks for every now and again, but I mean, nothing really serious. And I just wanted to keep my head down initially and get by. And as I was doing that, I began to get overcome with these feelings of anger and resentment toward everybody I pretty much came into contact with. Friends who seemed to have easier lives than I did. My parents who were telling me what to do too much. There was nothing during my upbringing or during my childhood or something. And like I said, this was just my head. There's nothing but that was comforting to me, that I derived joy from. Everything like seemed like a task or a chore. And some days I would just have enough of it. But I knew I had to keep my mouth shut, so I did. One time, and this went well, not well into my teens, but into my teens. And then for people my age, a pretty common bucket list item is to go to a Grateful Dead show. And so my first act of real defiance, other than maybe running away from home, and by running away from home, like running like 3 blocks down the street and sitting in the park for like, 6 hours or something like that. My first real major act of defiance when I was 14 was to go to Alpine Valley in 1985 for a Dead show. And I spent the weekend there. Somebody hooked me up. At the time, I had a landscaping job. And guys who I would find out look a lot like people who go to Dead shows are the kind of types that I worked with that summer. And so they hooked me up with tickets. The Grateful Dead would come to Alpine Valley like forever, it seemed, back in those days. And they would spend like, a week there. They'd play like 7 shows. And so I went for 2. And I'm thinking, I heard the guys playing bootlegs and stuff, and I thought the music kind of sucked, and quite frankly, still do. And it's all I heard in college, all that anybody ever played. And then Fish was coming up, and And so anyway, I went to this Dead show, and it was like I went to another planet, and it was frightening to me, and it was like, all these people like, and I'm like, there's nothing appealing about this to me at all. And it's as if Alpine Valley was a big outdoor theater. It was kind of into some mountains and stuff, and there were some hills, not some mountains. And it was as if somebody filled a bomb with patchouli, bong water, and BO and dropped it there. They were all doing drugs, and I could smell the reefer all over the place. Everybody's drinking, everybody's doing drugs, people were tripping their, all that kind of stuff. I've heard the experience from other alcoholics that when they encountered a situation like that for the first time, they were like, this is where I belong. And that was not my experience. I wanted to get out of there. And it was only because I didn't want to look uncool that I didn't say, I want to go home. Because I really did, But I didn't drink, I didn't drug, I didn't do anything. I just wanted to get out of there. So, I did what I did when I was with my folks. I kept my head down and shut up and tried to look cool and looked like I was comfortable, even though I wasn't. A couple of years later, I would finally drink. And I was in a situation where I normally would not find myself. Every now and again, I would get the courage to do something out of the box, out of my comfort zone, whatever the hell ever, And so I in this case, it was to talk to this girl that I had this massive crush on, and it turned out that she was throwing a party because her folks were out of town, and I figured this was my opportunity to, talk to her. So I went. And I honestly didn't go with the intention of drinking. I just went to because I wanted to talk to this girl. And I didn't talk to girls. I didn't do that stuff. I was scared to death of girls. I was scared to death of everything. I get there. She's making out with another guy, and I'm devastated. Never said a word to her. And this would be a thought pattern that I would have for the duration of my alcoholism and well into my sobriety. And we talk about being self-centered, and it's like, how dare she? I'd never spoken a word to her. And how dare he? Doesn't he know that I was going to talk to her tonight? And No, he didn't and she didn't because you haven't said a damn thing. But I had to get sober in AA to figure out that that's what the problem was, you know. And so it didn't work out, and I'm about to leave the place. And a couple upperclassmen that I played hockey with noticed my presence at the party because I wasn't the kind of kid who did that kind of stuff. My parents kept me on a tight leash. I had to finagle all sorts of things to get to this place. And they had a table much like the coffee table over there, and they were doing drinks on and that kind of stuff. And they cleared it off, and at the time, I'm like 5'4 and a buck 20. And they cleared it off and threw me down on the table and jammed a beer bong down my throat. And those were my first drinks, the first three or four or whatever. And I hated it. I was struggling, and which didn't do any good because they were all like massive. And and they finally let me up, and I was again looking for my mom, and I walked away from the party, and I walked outside, and I had what was nothing less than a cathartic belch, that just that you could have heard 10 miles away. And then I was overcome by this feeling that I've heard every alcoholic in AA talk about one time or another when they're telling their story. This warmth, this sense, these feelings that were so foreign to me because I had never experienced self-confidence or being secure in who I was or not being afraid. And I'd never experienced that ever in my life. And it all hit me in that instant. And I think the girl that I was pining over and all that kind of stuff, I didn't care. I started thinking I was a ladies' man, freaking 5'4", pimples all over the place. I'm like, yeah, I'm going to start scoring now, That would happen for like another 6 years, but, it's... I'm here to tell you that it was that experience. Now, I would go home and I would barf all over the place. The room, I tried to go to bed and I almost got away with it, but I didn't know the leg trick yet when you go to bed. So I started getting the spin, something serious, and I started barfing all over the place. And looking back on it, I'm sure I was an alcoholic right then. And it's because I offered my first pledge to my mother that night when she caught me barfing in the bathroom. I will never do this again. And that was totally a lie. I actually knew as I was barfing my guts out that this experience was a seminal experience in my life. This was worth going after no matter what the cost. And the cost didn't seem that bad. I throw up. I'll learn how to deal with that, and all that kind of stuff. And I'll learn how to, but this is what I've been looking for. I want to feel bigger than I am. I want to feel better than I am. And I want to be someone else. That's how I felt my entire life, and that's what booze did for me. Now, I should emphasize here, it didn't really do it for me. It made me feel that way. I was still a jackass. It just made me feel differently. And so I'd spend the next 16 years or so chasing that effect. And I didn't use words like effect when I was drinking. That's in the big book and stuff. And the effect is that everything's all right. And I almost immediately from that day forward, my priorities in life changed, and it was not about getting into college or doing well in athletics or anything. I was one of these guys who had a lot of potential, but I had to work for it. I had no natural ability whatsoever to do anything. I had no natural intelligence. I know it. Athletic or anything like that, but I found that if I worked hard at something, I could actually have a modicum of success. But I had to work for it, which was highly, unappealing to me. But I did that until I found booze. And then when I found booze, I felt like I didn't need to realize my potential anymore because all I had to do was drink. And then if I had potential, it didn't matter, or I was everything I wanted to be, So I would go away to college, and that's kind of when the floodgates opened. And I went to college for some athletics and stuff. And in my senior year, I blew up my knee really bad, and it was one of those like Joe Theismann things. It wasn't a compound fracture, but it looked like one. From that I was pretty good, but I would drink quite a bit and all that kind of stuff. And even when I was in training and not drinking for a while, I always thought about when I could drink next. That was always, you know, I think that was a legacy, one of the many legacies of my first drunk, was that I was always thinking about when I was going to be able to drink next. And I found almost immediately that even in high school, when kids had to go through a lot to drink, that it wasn't as important to them as it was to me. I remember I grew up in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and like to conceal booze from my parents, Milwaukee kind of had a lax attitude back then towards drinking. There's always liquor stores that would sell they would sell beer to a 5-year-old, and you know, but you couldn't bring it in the house, so I kept it in the car. The problem is in Wisconsin, it's like below freezing like 6 months out of the year, and so if you leave it in your car, it blows up. So I'd go through this, you know, I'd have all these frozen beers and I'd want to drink and I'd go to somebody's house. And if they were frozen, most of the kids are like, well, let's just, you know, screw around with girls or do whatever. I didn't care about any of that. I wanted to drink. So remember, friends of ours had a sauna, so I put the beers in the sauna and I would close the door and like look through the window of the sauna, like kind of watching the thawing process. Everybody else is having a good time and watching movies and doing, you know, pretty much normal stuff. I got a drink. And people are like, what the hell's the matter with you? And this is when I'm in my teens. Imagine how that looks when you're in your, like, you know, late 20s, you know, because I was doing the same thing. It was always, my sponsor when I got to AA would explain to me that the way you measure an alcoholic is by the importance he places on drinking. And the way you measure that is by what he's willing to give up in order to drink. And from very early on, I made the decision, although I didn't have to, you know, initially at least take it too far, that I was willing to give up everything in order to drink. That there was nothing that you could approach me with, and if the option were to drink or to do that thing, I would do that other thing. You know, I always chose booze, and eventually I chose it over my family. I chose it, I mean, I didn't choose it. I mean, nobody, we don't choose. I'm sorry, that was terrible that I just said that. You don't have a choice. You scream that at meetings all the time, and here I am talking about it. So, but, I mean, I drank instead of having a relationship with my family. I drank instead of, you know, having a good health eventually. By the time I got to AA, my parents had taken me back in, even though I hadn't spoken to them in about 4 or 5 years. I was 32 when I got to AA. And about a year prior, you know, my liver was distended. I got winded walking up a flight of stairs at my house. This is coming from somebody who played hockey a little bit professionally and cross country in college. And when I'm in my early 30s, I can't even get up a flight of stairs without feeling like I'm going to pass out. You know, I had a distended liver a little bit, and you know, if you grazed it right here, I would double over in pain. And what I didn't notice until I got sober was how far down I had gone. You know, I don't appreciate like how bad it gets until I look back on it. I think the phenomenon, at least for me, is the way alcoholism, one of the many ways is that alcoholism runs roughshod over my life, is that it allows me or tells me to lower my standards in such a way where my drinking is still suitable and acceptable. Now, very clearly, it isn't to anyone else, but it is to me. And because I'm self-centered, no, what everybody else thinks doesn't really matter now, does it? And that's the way I approach life. And, I mean, I'll tell you, when I got sober and I began to get through actions in AA and stuff, things, I got welcomed back into my family and I was able to be employed again. And especially when I made my ninth step amends, I mean, my overwhelming experience in my ninth step amends is that everybody told me what happened when I was drinking, and for the first time, I listened. And that was a hell of a thing to hear. It was probably more revealing to me than my fifth step was. When you hear your mom, your dad, and you don't storm out of the house because your sponsor is going to kill you if you leave, and you listen. And you don't say but, and you don't say you don't understand. You just sit there and listen. And I'll tell you, it was very hard to hear, but it was very revealing to make those amends to friends and family and even people I had very limited contact with. You know, like Gene, I was one of those guys who, I mean, I was in and out of your life very quickly. I have one lifelong friend, you know. I mean, I went to college for 4 years, you know, high school, all that kind of stuff. I didn't form any real relationships. I, you know, and I've heard a lot of alcoholics relate to this experience. You hang around people for a little bit, and then they're used up, or they're uninteresting, or someone's got something going on better. And the thing is, you believe you're making those decisions based on something real, but you're not. At least I wasn't. You know, my life was being run by alcohol, and wherever it was is where I had to go. And if somebody couldn't deal with it, well, that was just too bad. You know. And I was unsympathetic and uncaring and unkind and impatient with everyone when they got between me and booze, you know. And I love how the big book remarks it, you know, we're grand, you know, some people are grand old fellows or whatever the hell it says. When we're not drinking, grand chap, whatever. I wasn't at all. I mean, I was pretty pissed because I wasn't drinking. That was the whole. And everywhere I went, I tried to find a way to make it work for my drinking, you know, and every relationship I had, and everywhere I worked. This is the one group that, I mean, I've had a couple home groups, but this is the one group I've pretty much gone to the entire time I've been in Tampa on a regular basis. And it sounds condescending when I say it, but I'll tell you, there's something about getting your sober. I don't have this regret anymore, but early on I wish I had gotten sober when I was younger. I was telling somebody the other day, when I was like 3 or 4 years sober, I had to do a detailed work history, and that sucks for any alcoholic pretty much, but I mean, but I was off. And this was for an organization that really checked their stuff. You know, they weren't just looking for felonies or anything like that. They talked to people. And, you know, and I got the dates on all my jobs wrong. And not by months, by years. So the time of my 20s when I graduate from college, I mean, and I'm living in a city where a lot of people are beginning their careers and it's a fun time and it's a hell of a place to be at this time. And I'm given opportunities to do well and succeed. I was in Washington, D.C., and, you know, I totally got a job. I got two jobs I didn't deserve. One was working for a representative in Congress, you know, and, you know, that's a hell of an opportunity for someone just out of college, no graduate degree or anything like that. And I got arrogant and thinking that I deserve more. You know, I thought I should be put to better use and that, you know, the issue of grazing rights was not worthy of my attention. And so I went to the grazing rights convention and I got plowed and I got fired the next day. And, you know, and then I got a job with a law firm and all I had to do was not screw up. It was an easy job and I would have gotten serious financial assistance, if not a free ride, to go to a very good law school. And I decided that, well, you know, and I started drinking at lunch and then I started drinking at breakfast and I started drinking at work. And they didn't want me around anymore. So I had a lot of opportunities. There's nothing about my life where I didn't have opportunities or where I didn't catch a break. I had a lot of opportunities. And, you know, the shame and regret and I really began to start hating myself. I don't remember much about my 20s except pretty much hating myself. I started experiencing that thing. I went to AA for the first time when I was 25. There was a meeting at the Improv on Connecticut Avenue in Washington, D.C. at lunchtime. So I'd pull up in the Budweiser truck I was then driving. See all these, like, newcomer alcoholics with cigarettes and stuff, you know. I'm like, hey, I'm here to get sober. You know. And they'd say, well, I don't think you're too serious, and I'd get offended. So obviously I didn't stay sober, and when I was 28, I went to meetings again because I'd done something, and this is another true experience. I'd done something I swore I would never do, and I was living with a girl at the time, and I smacked her, and You know, I'd never done that. And the remorse and the regret over doing that, I was drunk. You know, I got to change my ways. And, you know, eventually I was okay with it without doing anything about it. And that's pathetic. And it's disgusting, you know. But that's the kind of grip that booze has on me. That even though I do things that at one point in my life were detestable to me, none of that stuff is ever going to make me stop. By the time I'm coming in AA, it's my birthday weekend. I don't want to live anymore. I don't want to say I was suicidal, because if I was suicidal, I would have killed myself. But I didn't want to live anymore. And part of me had this creeping fear that I would, that I would live like that for a very long time. I'd be one of those guys with a worn-out flannel robe, wearing a wife beater with a friggin' spaghetti stain, you know, wearing moccasins, and a beat-up lazy boy watching the television, cracking a beer every 10 minutes. And I would look at guys like that when I was younger. I would look at guys at the bars I would drink at, you know, and the bars I would drink at were not cool. Most of the people when I went drinking, you know, my 20s and stuff, were 20, 30 years older than I was, you know. And I would look at them like, man, they're here at 7 o'clock in the morning. Well, how do I know that they're at 7 o'clock in the morning? Because I'm there at 7 o'clock in the morning. You know, what do these guys do for a living? Well, just the hypocrisy was, I didn't see it. It all had to get pointed out to me, you know. I was incapable. I think, you know, as I think more about the insanity of alcoholism, and for some reason I've been ending up at a lot of step two, I'm insane meetings or whatever. I think the true measure of my insanity is that I was incapable of seeing the truth, even when it was right in front of my face, you know. What happened, and the reason I came to AA, and I suppose I stayed, was because I could not offer a defense anymore. I'd wake up every morning, and I would look in the mirror, and I'd hate myself, and I'd make heartfelt resolutions not to drink, and I would drink anyway. I knew I had to stop. I had no doubt I was an alcoholic. I had no doubt I was selfish or dishonest. I knew all those things. I had hated what I had become. I was angry because I wasn't supposed to end up this way. I wasn't supposed to be like this. Come from a good home. I went to good schools. I'm a smart kid. Blah, 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 blah. Why is it like this? So what better place to sound off those feelings than in a freaking AA meeting? Because they have to listen to you. You know, we have to be patient and crap. You know, and so we let people sound off. But I'll tell you, the thing is, that's how I came to AA. And no one else wanted me around anymore. But they told me to come back. And then one guy said, I'm picking you up tomorrow. And I didn't understand the flip side of that. He said, I'm going to pick you up, and I'm going to tell you what to do basically for the next 3.5 years. So, I didn't come into AA. And, if you're one of those folks who doesn't feel like you belong here, you're in the right place. And that's a good thing, because you really have nowhere else to go. And I was in the right place. I was surrounded by people, and I didn't appreciate this at the time. They pretty much would have done everything to see me get sober another day. You know, they wouldn't do the things I wanted them to do that I thought were helpful. They thought they did things that were helpful. Like, point out the truth to me. Tell me what to do each and every day in order to stay sober. Reprioritize my life. Each and every day you are to do these things. You're going to pray and meditate when you wake up and when you go to bed. You're going to read the big book. You're going to talk to another alcoholic. You're going to do everything I tell you to do. And I did those things, not believing that they were going to do anything. I'm here to tell you that nothing that I've done to keep me sober and to stay sober and to have the life that I've been given started with me saying, ooh, I can't wait to do that. It was all like, this is so messed up. Do you guys really buy into this? Is this really the program? You know? I was such a wise aunt. And I'll tell you, I was lucky enough to fall in a bunch of people who make me look like a nice guy. And I'll tell you why. Because they were more concerned about me staying sober and staying alive than me liking them. They didn't really care how I felt about them. They knew that I didn't know how to care about my own sobriety, so they cared about it for me. And they would, when I came up with one of these crazy objections, these crazy reservations that we have to AA, you know, all these things that we say, that why AA won't work for us, even though it's worked for everybody who's actually worked it, they would respond in such a way that I would never object ever again. And I didn't like them, you know. I've got a few minutes, and I want to share with you that I never thought my life would end up the way it has. And to tell you the truth, I think I was so far gone that I didn't even know what I wanted anymore by the time I got to AA. I mean, I had a vision like, you know, but what I realized, and Gene alluded to this too, was that, you know, the idea of having the great job and the great house and the great wife and the great car, I think in the back of my mind, I had a growing suspicion that that wasn't going to cut it for me. You know, that even if I could get those things, which I couldn't because I was drunk all the time, that wasn't what was going to cut it. But the frustrating thing is I didn't know what it was. So the rub is, for those of you who are new, is that you don't know what you are looking for. You have to have faith and trust that what we have and what we're willing, you know, that what we're more than willing to share with you, what we hope that you will take with all the desperation of a drowning man, so to speak, is an answer that you would have never thought of on your own. So, of course, it's not going to make sense to you. You know, you're going to say stuff like, what does that have to do with staying sober? And the answer is everything. You just don't see it yet. My overwhelming experience in AA has always been, you do what you're told now, you find out why later, and the results happen when you stop obsessing over when the damn results are going to happen. When am I going to get this? When am I going to get this? Shut up! And just do it, is what I was told. I'm not really sure, you know, you can't help it. A lot of things have happened to me that I don't deserve. I've got the greatest wife in the wide world, and I've got a job where people are going to miss me. They say it, like, not like in that way. Like I'm leaving my job in a couple days, and you know, and people have asked me not to go. That's never ever happened to me ever. You know, and it doesn't mean I'm a great guy or anything like that. It means I kept my commitments. I did what I said I was going to do when I said I was going to do it, and I had no manner of doing that before I got to AA. You know, I didn't know how to be a boyfriend, much less a husband or anything like that. I didn't know how to be a friend. I didn't know how to help people. Everything that happened to me in AA was experiential. And there's a depth and weight to the experience here that at first you do it because you're told to, but it becomes part of you. If all AA was doing one thing when you wanted to be doing another, no one would stay. But I believe the way that God works in my life is that over time and through steps and through action and all that kind of thing, what you want to do and what you ought to do come closer and closer together. I found that God's will is going to happen no matter what. It is irrevocable. What causes my unhappiness, what causes my anger, what causes my resentment and my fear and a host of other character defects is when I insist it has to be another way. When I'm okay with what's going on in this world, you know, everything's great. And I don't feel lost. And I don't wonder, what am I going to do or anything like that. These were things that my life was shot through with. You know, I mean, there was never a day did not go by where I didn't say, what am I going to do? How am I going to get out of this one? You know, and I'll tell you, it's worth its weight in gold to not ask that question anymore, at least for me. You know, I mean, it's to not be backed into a corner all the time, to not have to dig myself out of one thing after the other, you know? I mean, to not feel like whale shit, you know? I mean, and it, that was a cuss word. I get one. You know, those weren't things that I experienced. I mean, throughout my drinking, like, I had, like, car wrecks, and I got arrested and all that kind of stuff, but that's not why I'm here. Why I'm here is how I live my life day in and day out. That just terrible inadequacy, that feeling horrible about myself and horrible about the world, just not really wanting to live or seeing the point in living, you know. Gene talking about it being pointless. I can totally relate to that, drunk or sober. I don't have that problem anymore. I come to AA, I see good examples, you know, coming, who came before me and who come after me. People who have achieved a lot of things that it seems, you know, if it truly was a just world, I remember clamoring a lot, it isn't fair. It's, you know, my first sponsor would say, oh, you want justice? You want what you deserve? Yeah. Go home and pray for that. And he said it pretty much just like that. And he was able to make me feel like I shouldn't be asking for what I deserve. Because I shouldn't. I've been given something amazing here. And it's been a real wonderful ride. I can't tell you enough that... You're not supposed to know where you're going. It's not supposed to make sense to you. You just have to do it. And then you look back and you evaluate your life just a little bit. You take a moment out of every day and say that this is what God has given me. And you look at it and you love it. Thanks.